Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vatitamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. 13. Etachutwa. Etachutwa samparigrihya martyah. Etachutwa samparigrihya martyah. Pravrihya dharmyam anumetam apya. Pravrihya dharmyam anumetam apya. Samodate modadiyam hiladhwa. Samodate modadiyam hiladhwa. Vivrittam sadma nachiketa sammanye. Vivrittam sadma nachiketa sammanye. Etat shrutva samparigrihya martyaha. Pravrihya dharmyam anum etamapya. Samodate modaniyam ilabdhva. Vivrittam sadma nachiketasam manye. In the last two lines of verse 12, he says, Adhyatma Yoga Adhigamena Devam Matva Diraha Arshashoka Jahati. This is Yama, Lord Yama, talking to Nachiketas. He says, at first, the first thing he says is at the top two lines, he says, that the self, which is very difficult to see, right, the self, this conscious being, this me, is very difficult to see because I can't objectify myself. Who's going to be looking at me? Right? So the sense organs that I have available to me and the means of knowledge I have available to me cannot objectify myself so that I can have a subject-object relationship and say, oh, like this is a cup. I can't say, nor can the teacher say, oh, look, this is a self. This is yourself. And so the means of gaining this knowledge is going to be quite a bit different than what we're used to. Right, so we need a special pramana, a special means of knowledge to hold up a mirror to the very subject that your sense organs and mind can't just turn around and look at, because then who's the self that's illumining that? And so the whole problem is, you can call it a problem, it is a problem in a way, because the self is hidden in the seeker as the very nature of the one who wants to know. That's what makes it dur darshan. Difficult to see, because you don't have the means of knowledge to see it. You only can be it. You are it, but the me that you are is not something that could be objectified by your sense organs or by inference or by the means of knowledge that you have available. But since you are a conscious being, you are your own self-evident experience, and yet from the standpoint of your mind, like the snake, you know, your snake and the snake rope analogy, from the standpoint of the snake, it just takes itself to be the rope. There's no viveka, there's no discrimination. It would say, I have five bends, those five bends are me. I'm an inch in diameter, that's how big I am. I'm 5 feet long, that's how long I am. It has no way to differentiate itself, its mitya self, its dependent self, from the actual being that it is. So the thing is, it just assumes itself to be of the nature of the rope. So the snake becomes the rope, and the rope becomes the snake. from the standpoint of the snake, right? And from the standpoint of the rope, there is no snake. The rope has no problem. That's our situation here. Conscious being, the me, has no problem. Because my being is actually not being touched, like what I was trying to kind of focus on in the meditation, my being, the me, is not being touched or tampered with at all by all of the, you know, by the weather, the emotional weather, or by the thoughts that are coming and going. From my standpoint, nothing is happening, and I am not even a knower. Consciousness is not a knower. It is known. It is self-evident knownness. So even it's another thing when we do the contemplation is to notice that I am this conscious being, I simply am. And I am known, not because there's a knower, but because I am consciousness. I am the experience of knownness. And then anything that we call mithya, the whole maya, that comes into my purview as a jiva, as an individual, everything, every single experience that comes my way, whether it be an emotion or a memory or a perception, all of them are known. So my experience is all the way, taking all the maya into account, the totality of my experience, the totality of my experience that comes my way, what it has in common is that when it's there, it is and it is known. Always. There's no exception. Any experience you have, it is known. Right? So, the isness and is-knownness, these are just two words for the sat-chit, conscious being that I am. It doesn't make me a knower. Everything is known because the self is the self-luminous being that lights up every experience, but that doesn't make the self a knower. Right? So if you get away, if you get take away the mind, and the mind which is responsible for all of the thoughts, all of the moods, all of the vrittis, all of the thought modifications, all of those are known, and then the sense organs which give you all the external perceptions, those are the instruments that allow for the mind to have one thought after another thought after another thought. You know? And all of those thoughts are known. But from the standpoint of the mind, the ahankara, the I notion, acknowledges or labels me, conscious being, as the knower, and labels the contents of the mind, like in this case, this room that I'm looking at through my eyes, as the known. So we get this knower-known construct. But when we analyze it, there's just the known. And so, in contemplation, this is, and in gaining this knowledge, this is so important, because we always think of ourselves as ultimately the knower. Ultimately, when we do the drisha, the seer-seeing differentiation, in the end, the one who's left standing is the knower, right? But actually, the knower is known. Right? There is no knower. There's just conscious me. Right? Conscious being, which is me. And so in contemplation, what do you recognize when I have asked you for the mind to gently just shift its focus to my own presence? Then I can say, is that presence, we didn't say that this time, but we often do, is that presence, is that me doing anything? Is it knowing anything? No, it's simply the knownness which all things enjoy. Right? And that knownness can't objectify itself into a subject-object relationship, nor does it need to. It is my self-evident, the self-evident self-experience that is me. Right? And so Yama says to Nachiketas, you know, this is not easy to see because it's not something that can be objectified in a subject-object relationship. It has entered into hiding. It is hiding. It is hiding as the very subject, the ultimate subject, because of which all things are known. It is there, he says, abiding there in the guha, abiding there in the buddhi, in the cave of the heart. Abiding there, and that's often used for the buddhi, the intellect. Abiding there is the very conscious being which the mind enjoys. Hidden there, Gahureshtam, he says, amidst all this body, mind, sense organs, he says, amidst this calamity, the calamity of the body, mind, sense organs, because everything about your body, your mind, your sense organs, all of it, are all subject to coming and going, all subject to change. So there's nothing that you can grab onto. The body, of course, will go through birth and death, and the mind goes through sukha dukkha, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain. So there's nothing really stable here that we can hang on to or feel secure. But so we're always searching for some sort of security amidst the absolutely insecure. So we're trying to find something where we can take a rest amidst things which are changing. So we just find little places where we can hang on to for a short period of time, relax for a moment, as long as that will last, and try to cut over to something else when that becomes more unstable. Okay, so he says in this verse 12, having recognized the Atma, Devam is the Atma, having recognized Matva Devam, having known, having recognized the self, through Adhyatma Yoga Adhigamena, through that contemplation, through that teaching that brings, Adhyatma Yoga means it brings the mind to the recognition of my own being. Adhyatma Yoga Adhigamena, by the gain of that Adhyatma Yoga. Adhyatma Yoga means a yoga that is centered on myself, which is a teaching. Adhyatma Yoga Adhigamena. Through that means the dhiraha, the one who has this viveka. The dhira means the person who has a buddhi, an intellect which has viveka. Viveka means now, as the teaching continues, your mind is able to discriminate the Atma, which is self-evident from all the experiences that are coming and going. That's viveka. The viveka jnanam means the knowledge that is brought about by that discrimination between my being and all of the experiences that exist within time and space, including all my thoughts and moods and emotions and all of my perceptions, all of the things that are coming and going. That viveka means through the use of the pramana, really the teaching methodology, at least from the standpoint of the way we teach it in Advaita Vedanta, that teaching methodology, I'm guided to recognize, to differentiate my self-shining conscious being, my self-shining changeless presence, from all the experiences, including, as Vaghishananda says, the weather, the emotional weather, you know, and all of the perceptual material, the emotions, the memories, fantasies, whatever my mind is capable of, on perceptions, whatever my mind is capable of, I had that viveka to differentiate my own presence from those experiences. And that dhira who does that, harsha shokal jahati, he gives up, he lets go of, abandons harsha and shoka, elation and sorrow. Harsha is that elation that makes your hairs on your body stand on end. That horrible elation. So harsha, where you're just so happy and excited, and shoka, where you're so down. So the pleasure and pain cycle, he gives all of that up. Why? It's not even a giving up exactly. It's a recognition that I'm totally free from all of that. It's not that they don't exist, but they don't touch me in any way. Like the snake cannot touch the rope. It can't be without the rope, but it can't touch the rope. And from the standpoint of the rope, nothing is happening. The rope's not saying, oh my God, I turned into a snake. I didn't want to turn into a snake. Yeah. There is no snake. This is exactly the situation for you, for your being. There is no snake. Nothing is happening to you. Your being is whole and complete. All that is happening, there's a lot happening, but all that is happening is from the standpoint of the snake, from the standpoint of the mind, from the standpoint of the emotions, from the standpoint of the world. All kinds of things are happening, but they're all Mitya. Mitya is the order of reality, which means it has no independent being that has the capacity to come into competition or touch me or change me in any way. And myself, because I'm not a knower, because I am self-evident me, consciousness, all of these things that are happening are simply illumined by me. The self doesn't have a mind. The self illumines the mind. The self is the very being, the conscious being, which the mind enjoys. But from its own standpoint, it doesn't have a mind. It's not thinking. It's not seeing. When calamitous things are going on in the world, it's not going, I wish I didn't have to experience that. It is not experiencing it. So my being is the most stable thing imaginable because it's non-dual and nothing happens to me, and yet I'm the very being which the whole universe enjoys, in fact. So with that verse, now he goes on in the one that we just chanted, number 13, talking, bringing to light the teaching methodology. So he says, etat shrutva. Etat atmatattvam. Etat means the truth of myself, the truth of the self. Shrutva. Having heard. Having heard means shravana. Remember? Having listened to. The, what we call upaya nishta, which means that which is the means of the sadhana for gaining this knowledge is called upaya nishta. It's a commitment to this particular teaching methodology, which is what? Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana has to do with what we're doing right now, where the shastra is being unfolded in a particular manner with the intent of taking the student's mind step by step by step to recognizing the vision that is contained in the Upanishads. So the Upanishads themselves are a pramana. They're a teaching tradition that is passed on between teacher and student. They're not really a book. We have a book here, but they are not a book. It's a living teaching between teacher and student. And so that teaching has been written down, but it's not a book that you can read. It's a book that needs to be taught. And then once it's taught, you can read it. It's like that. Because it's a teaching methodology. So he says, etat shrutva, having been exposed to the teaching, having been exposed to this atma-tattvam, the truth of the self, of the atma, of your being, then sam-parigrihya, sam means to do it thoroughly, pari means looking for around from every direction, and doing it thoroughly, what? Grihya, sam-parigrihya, having grasped it, manana, means this knowledge is being unfolded, so that the student can see what the Upanishads have to say. Right? So with the samparigrihya, say that the pramana, the teaching is going on, you can initially have some of the questions, well, what is the Upanishad saying here? I don't understand this, I don't understand that. So then there, in part of Shravana itself has to do with answering all of these questions and doubts so that you're very clear, you see the vision of the Upanishads, you see it, you get it. But then another level of questionings can come in, which is looking at all of the other darshanas, all of the other ways that it could be. So you can say, well, the Upanishads say this, and I see it, but why couldn't it be like this? Or what about this? It could be like that. And so the samparigrihya means no stone left unturned. Pari, they use an example often in India of an amalaka fruit. It's a little round fruit. A really nice little fruit. It's amalaka fruit. They say, like an amalaka fruit in the palm of your hand. How you can see all the way around it. It's small, so you can look all the way around. That's pari. You can see it from all different angles. So like that, all of the questions that come up into your mind, all of those questions, like why couldn't it be like this, or what if it was this, that, whatever, all of those questions are part of this teaching, the manana. Those questions are very, very important, because until you have clarity around those questions, you don't really have knowledge. Right? Because those questions, and nor should you, that question is a doubt. You know, you have a doubt. A doubt means that in this area I don't know, I don't understand. So that means that there's still more to know. And so it's important, and this is true in India, not just for Advaita Vedanta, but it's something beautiful about the whole Indian tradition, is this understanding, this respect for your mind. There's a respect for your mind, that your mind is the one that has ignorance, and the mind is the one that has to gain knowledge. It's not about going beyond the mind. The mind is the one that has the problem, right? So you can go beyond the mind, like for instance, that to me this is a, not to me, but to our tradition, this actually is a huge problem. Like say if you say, the self is not anything that can be known, it can't be objectified, of course. You know, and so what we have to do is just shut down our experience and shut down our mind. We have to go beyond the mind. We have to close down the mind, to shut it down, to resolve the mind. For instance, let me go into nirvikalpa samadhi and stay there. Nirvikalpa samadhi means I have, in meditation, I have withdrawn all of my sense perception, withdrawn my mind, and focused it just totally on, I would say in Vedanta, nididhyasana, just on my own being. But in normally, it would be if people are talking about that, I would have nirvikalpa samadhi, I would shut everything down and have a non-dual experience. You know? But if it's that's all it is, Swamiji will call that jada samadhi. That non-dual experience that has nothing to do with knowledge, it has to do with drugs or pranayama or whatever, has caused me to have that non-dual experience. When my mind comes back from that non-dual experience, what it says is, I had this non-dual experience. I know that is the truth. I know that is the truth of my own being. I know that's what it is. How can I have that again? How can I get that again? Which means that the ahankara, the I notion, remains with the mind. The mind has had this experience, the mind is the knower, and it has had this non-dual experience of the self. You know? But now that I've come back, that non-dual experience is gone. How can I get it back again? Right? That's exactly the trap there.
Yeah.
That's the dur-darshan. That's what makes it so difficult, because the I notion, that where my ego is so firmly entrenched in the mind-body sense organs. Absolutely entrenched. Because of the nature of the creation. It's not like you're born into this creation, this body and mind, and you're saying, no, this really is not me. And that's the opposite of, of course this is you. And of course it is you. Just like the truth of the snake is the rope. Why shouldn't it say, I am the rope? Not using the word rope. I am 5 feet long and so many bends, because that is its truth.
But it's really just a very
and
small.
My truth,
yeah.
And my truth is conscious being, me. I am my truth. But my body, mind, sense organs, as long as it's alive, is never away from that. So why should it not take itself to be me and be firmly entrenched in that? So the mind has a beginningless, most natural self-ignorance. And that self-ignorance can't just go away by having an experience, because the experience does not change the position of the ahankara, the I notion. The I notion remains very much intact. And now it's had this experience, which is a great beacon light, and you know it's the truth, and how to get that back. The ahankara, there has to be a shift from the ahankara, the I notion, to the ahankara, the I notion, landing on the body, mind, sense organs, has to make a shift. to landing on me. But to land on me, it has to recognize me. But there's no me to land on. It's already landing on me in the form of the mind. It's landing on me in the form of the body. It's not landing on me, myself. You see what I mean? So now what he says, so this samparigrihya, having understood thoroughly, means all doubts, all questions have been worked through. The martyaha, the mortal. Mortal means the person. Mortal, there's the person, you are not mortal. You're not a mortal. But you take yourself to be one. So we might as well call you one. You take yourself to be mortal, right? It means subject to birth and death. So you take yourself to be that, so we call you, from that standpoint, the one who takes it yourself to be mortal, we call you somebody subject to death, because for you, you're subject to death. That's our plight. We all think we're going to die. Because if I take myself to be this body, I'd be foolish not to think I'm going to die. I just try to prolong it for as long as possible, but I know that I will die. So that ajnanam, that self-ignorance, is going to give me this sense of my own mortality. So now he says, so this martyaha, first, having done this shravana, really been exposed to this teaching, and then having cleared all of the doubts, then he says, pragrihya, nididhyasana. Pragrihya means having, through viveka, singled out, differentiated, dharmyam, my being, dharmyam, my being, from the body, mind, sense organs. Having singled out, there's different ways of taking that, but dharmyam is that thing which is the essence of dharma. It's a potential part of dharmyam. That thing which does never transgresses dharma, which is the very being of dharma. So it's a word for the atma. It's also having recognized that which, in a sense, is, in terms of the whole Ishwara's creation, this whole Ishwara's creation is called dharma. All of the infinite order of this creation is the dharma. And that dharma has for its being that which is dharmyam, the very truth of this dharma. So the infinite order, all of the laws of the creation are called dharma. Dharmyam is the essence of that, which is the atma. So the atma, which is Brahman. So having, atma means the self, which is Brahman, the self which is non-dual, which is infinite. So he says, pragrihya dharmyam, having recognized that truth. Pragrihya means having singled it out, differentiated me. The first shravana, then manana, then recognizing me as I am, not from the standpoint of the maya upadis, not from the standpoint of the body, the mind, the sense organs, the mitya, not from the standpoint of the snake, but from the standpoint of the rope. So not from the standpoint of all of these things that are coming and going, but from my own standpoint of my own being. Then, having done that, gained that, anum etam apya. Then what happens? Then, achieving this atma, etam, which is anum, the most subtle. Anum means smaller than the smallest. You can say both, you can go both ways. The smaller, that which is smaller than the smallest or larger than the largest, means that which is not something that can be objectified within time and space. Because say how small you go, it's smaller than that. As small as you can go, it's smaller than that. As large as you can go, it's larger than that. So that which is anu, this atma which is anu, means it's not something that can be available to you through your pramanas, through your means of knowledge. Because it's not objectifiable. If it's smaller than the smallest, there's nothing you can do now, right? Because you can see the smallest thing, but sorry, it's smaller than that. So anu means that which is the most subtle, not subject to objectification. Your being cannot be objectified into time and space, right? So within time and space. So having a chain, having gained that self, that Atman, which is Etat Anum, that Atman, which is Anum, the most subtle, Saha Modate, he rejoices, Modaniyam Hiladdwa, having gained Modaniyam, that which is the very source of joy. So he rejoices, or he has ananda, or fullness, or happiness, he experiences joy or happiness, having gained its very source. So it's now saying the Sat-Chit Ananda, Sat is my being, which is consciousness, which is absolute fullness. In fact, never is an objectified experience of joy. If there was, you see the lingas, you see the markings. Like somebody's really happy and they're laughing, or they just look like they're just full of tejas, and you're looking at them and thinking, I wish I was like that. You know? So but you're seeing markings, like somebody has a big smile or something. But the ananda, the joy is something, the fullness is something that is you, right? Not something that comes and goes. We do have these vrittis. We have vrittis that come and go. That's the problem. Thought modifications that come and go. Happy thoughts that come and go. But they come and go. And then we wonder, where is the source of that happiness? You know? Because that is what I want. When I'm feeling that happiness, that is when I know all is well with me. But then it continues to slip away. Because actually what I'm experiencing there, because not through really any fault of my own, the teacher has to come and hold up a mirror. What I am experiences are different thought modifications where they have a lot of shanti and relaxation. Usually from fulfilling a desire. Whenever you fulfill a desire, the mind becomes quiet. And that quietude, the mind kind of for a minute becomes as though invisible. It's still there, but it's not participating, it's not doing anything. Yeah. And so then it's just your own being that is reflecting nicely in that mind until something happens and then becomes tense again. And then something happens and becomes quiet. And you feel so happy. So at some point, what we have to do is realizing that these are just mental states, shantavrittis, mental states of a calm, quiet mind. It's kind of like a clear lake reflecting the sun. A very clear lake, the sun is there really shining in it, you know, and the lake thinks, this is how I'm supposed to be all the time. Don't anybody throw a dirt clod in me. I'm supposed to be like this, all of it is perfect. You know? The sun is the source of that reflection. So what has to happen, right, is that this knowledge has to hold up a mirror to that source of ananda, that the source of ananda that reflects in the mind is my own self. And it's never not there. It's just the ananda of myself is indicated, pointed to, by these different types of shantavrittis. It's pointed to, but it's different. It's different then, but pointed to. So all the shantavritti seems a mind where it's like a clear water bucket is relaxed and clear and quiet, where the positive spectrum of emotions are manifest, like love or joy or compassion or bliss or meditative experiences, the ones where I feel, This is me, this side of experiences. This is me, and these are not, you know, these I want to get rid of. These are the beautiful ones where I feel most like myself. That's what we live off of. This is what keeps me going, these little vrittis, these little types of thought modifications, that because they mirror me. That's why they mirror me, but they're not me. They mirror me. Who are they mirroring? That's what I have to recognize. the me that they are mirroring, and say to myself, sometimes in contemplation, why am I called Ananda? Why does the Shastra say that this me is Ananda? I don't feel like I'm in bliss at this moment, do you? See, Ananda is translated as bliss. I used to think, I'm not in bliss.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have some bliss so I can know myself. Right, so that is really a mess. It takes you in the really, really the wrong direction. What you have to do is, when you just relax, say when we're doing a guided meditation or you're doing your own meditation, you just let your mind ask, why am I, the one who is here right now, why am I labeled as Ananda, that which is fullness, or that which is love, or that which is, I like this one the best, that which is the most dear. And then if you say, what? Because that's Ananda, the one that is most dear, because nothing's more dear to you than Ananda. So why is this labeled as Ananda, that which is most dear? And you sit with that for a while and see, is there anything less dear? Is there, or more dear? Yeah? Is there anything more dear than that? And that can be a real wake-up call. Is there anything more dear than this me? And then you start to recognize how beautiful, how subtle this Ananda is. How simple, how normal, how natural, and how something that cannot be touched or surpassed in any way. It's, my being is of a different order of reality. It's of a different order of dearness. And to that dearness, these Ananda vrittis, these bliss vrittis and happy vrittis and love and all of these things that are vrittis that come and go, mental activities, they don't mean anything compared to this. They have their own beauty, but it's nothing compared to this. It's apples and oranges, it's mitya satyam. It's a totally different order of reality. So I have to sit with that and just simply ask that question. Because it's not about you gaining a bliss experience. It's about recognizing your being that is already fully 100% experientially present, not as an object, but as your own self. So you have to ask not these fluctuating thoughts and let the thoughts come and go. That's why I say you just welcome those thoughts. Don't bother about them. Just welcome them so they're not in the way. Mind isn't cramping around. I had this thought, and I had this thought, and going, building a web around those thoughts. You just let them be. And then just gently focus on your own presence and see who you are. It's an amazing thing. So he says, the person who has gone through this, recognized the self, he rejoices because, what? Because having gained that which is the thing to be rejoiced about, the very source of that happiness, modaniyam. Then he says, vivrittam sadma nachiketasam manye. He says, nachiketas, I consider you, nachiketas, I consider vivrittam sadma, this abode. Sadma is a mansion. That this mansion, and he's using like a metaphor, I consider this mansion of Brahman, of the self, to be vivritam. The doors of this mansion are open for you.
Mm.
Means because you're an adhikari, because you're a qualified student, he's Yama putting through all these tests, you know, and he was able to, without really any effort, just see kind of through the whole, you know, samsara of the whole thing. And then Shankara says, without his mind abiding like a still lake, nothing happening, you know, as Yama was offering him all of these things. And then he saw how astute you know, Nachiketa's was, as he was off telling him how to lay these bricks and do these rituals and whatnot, and Nachiketa was able to listen and just repeat the whole thing back to him and said, okay, and this young boy, as young as he is ready for this knowledge. And so that's what he says here. He tells Manana, Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, you know, and having understood through that teaching methodology, then that one who has understood, he rejoices, you know, having gained, because of having gained, that which is the very, you know, object, the very subject of the rejoicing itself. So then he says, I consider that this abode, this mansion, is wide open for you to enter. So Amji talks about this, he says something like, there's no doors that need to be opened for you. They're already open. You just have to walk through now. Because his mind is available. Everything's available for him. You know, it's not like he has to go somewhere. It's not like the mansion is over there somewhere. The mansion is here and his mind is there ready. His mind is there ready, open to receive this knowledge. And the knowledge is of a self which is already abiding there. So there's no, the Beaverton, this mansion is Beaverton is wide open for you. Means there are no pratibandhikas. Pratibandhikas means no obstructions hindering or slowing you down here for this. Okay. So having said that, Nachiketas, and here's how Shankara introduces the next verse. He says, yes, Nachiketa says, if, as you say, I am yogyaha, he says, I am qualified, speaking to Lord Yama, if, you, as you say, I'm yogyaha, I'm qualified, and prasannascha asi, and you are pleased with me, right? You are pleased, and if I am qualified and you are pleased with me, O Bhagawan, tell me this. That's how he introduces it. So let's just look at his question. And then
that was Shankar?
Shankar introduced in that way. Here's the verse. Anyatra dharma, anyatra, anyatra dharma, anyatra dharma, anyatra dharma, anyatra dharma, anyatrasmat krita kritat, anyatrasmat krita kritat, anyatra bhutat cha bhavyat cha yattat, anyatra bhutat cha bhavyat cha yattat, pashyasi tadvada, pashyasi tadvada. So he says, anyatra dharmat, anyatra adharmat, anyatra asmat, krita akritat, anyatra bhutat cha, bhavyat cha, yat tat pashyasi tadvada. He says, hey Bhagavan, O Lord, he says, tadvada, tell me that, may you tell me that which you see. Tell me that which you see, that which you know, which is anyatra, other than dharma, and anyatra adharma, other than dharma, and other than adharma, that which is free of punya and free of papa. Dharma, here we use dharma and adharma, we mean dharma are those behaviors that are in harmony, like in the golden rule, do unto others as you have done to yourself, and don't do to others as you wouldn't do to yourself. That is dharma, and that ethical behavior that is innate to all beings, really. Innate to all beings in this house. So I'm going to say here, it's innate to all beings in terms of how I should be treated. This is how all beings should treat me. Now, I'm not so good at treating all other beings that way, but I know that that's how I should be treated. So that innate dharma. So. But still, I keep making mistakes in terms of the way I treat others. I know how I want people to treat me, but I make mistakes. All we all do, we make mistakes. So, and we can't not make mistakes. As long as we don't have knowledge, especially as long as we don't have self-knowledge, my ananda, my very well-being, my very self is projected out onto the world, and then it's being attacked by everybody. People are jealous, people don't want me to have this, or to take this away, or they're in competition with this and that, you know? So all kinds of misery is caused to whatever degree I'm projecting my ananda onto the world. And it doesn't really matter what it is, it will cause misery to the whatever degree it's projected. So Nachiketa very wisely asks, is there anything that's beyond this? This dharma and a dharma. And then he says, anyatra asmat krita akrita. Is there anything that is beyond krita and akrita? Krita means that which is produced, akrita not produced. So there's two words used for cause and effect. Is there anything that's free from cause and effect, or is this an endless chain, you know, that I can't escape from? Is there anything, it's basically saying, is there anything free from dharma, adharma? Anything free from, in a sense, time? Anything free from change? Anything that's outside of this cause-effect relationship that we find ourselves contained in? And then he says, is there anything, anyatra bhutat cha bhavyatcha, is there anything that's free from the past and present, past and future, and then the present is understood? Is there anything free from time? Starts out with punyan papa, dharma adharma, then cause and effect. And then you say these things, then you might as well say, well, really, is there anything free from time, anything free from change, from the past and from the future. And so vartamana from the present also, as Shankara says, we always take that. So he says, kala trayena yena parichidyate. Is there anything that is not limited? Parichidyate, is there anything that's not limited by the three periods of time? The definition of satyam, of the truth, or that which is in reality, is that which is not subject to past, present, or future, that which cannot be negated in the past, present, or future. That is free from time. The satyam is free from time. Anything within mitya, within time and space, is time-bound, subject to change. So now he's saying, is there anything outside of time? Anything not limited by time? That's going to be something that is not going to be an object in the creation. So he says, that's what I need to know. Please tell me what you see here. If you're pleased with me, if you consider me to be qualified, this is what I want to know. And so here with this question, Nachiketa has refined his initial question. He's made his initial question, if you remember, his initial question had to do with, is there anything about me that survives death? Nobody knows this. Everybody argues over what is the nature of the self, the transmigrating jiva, or does it belong to the body, or who exactly is the self? What is the self? Nobody knows. All of the darshanas have something different to say about it, you know. And of course, and Shankara in his commentary, they says, yes, of course they have something different to say about it because they're stuck within time using their own means of knowledge. And so they're going to be arguing about this or that because they have no means of knowledge that can really answer this particular question. Because yourself is not going to be an object which you can then analyze. You can't even infer, because for an inference has to be within the same order of reality where the linga, the marking of the inference is going to be able to land on something. Right? If it can't land or have an invariable relationship with something, then there is no inference there. So of course there's going to be just a lot of unknown, basically. So then he says, and so Yama, you should be the Lord Death. You are the one to answer this question. You must know this. And so now, having gone through as much as we've gone through, he now, and as much teaching as Yama has again, he really hasn't started teaching yet, and he's still leading up to it. he makes his question very clear. And in the next verse that we'll start on for our next class, next week, he starts teaching, and he's the first part of the Upanishad really is on Om, mm-hmm. the meaning of Om. So we'll start with that next week.
Okay. You use the term Kri.
Wait a minute. What did you say?
You use the word, the Sanskrit word Kri.
Krita.
That's it.
What is Krita that? Means that which is made, that which is done. It comes from the root Kri.
Okay.
And Akrita, that which is not made. So Krita and Akrita means often cause and effect. The cause would be Akrita. It hasn't been made. Krita is what is made from that. So,
okay.
Just
thank you.
Yeah, let's say a prayer. Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahinaheshaha go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamcho barahitah Brahmanah santu nirbhayah Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah Sarve santu niramayah Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amitam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Did you say that Nachiketa's question changed?
Changed, no, just became more specific. You know, if you ask a question and then you just elaborate on it a little bit more. Because first he just wanted to know the nature of the self. right? And that nobody can really know this as well as you can, because we have no means of knowledge. Now he's been taught a little bit, and he's become himself more clear on the question. So what is there, what's beyond time, really? What's beyond the opposites? What's beyond the opposites? What's beyond cause and effect? What's beyond, you know, past, present, and future? Is there anything other than that?
Yeah.
So what I was asking, is one of the limitations of the rope snake analogy that the snake actually doesn't exist at all? I mean, it doesn't. There is no snake. So, I mean, we could say, well, there is no creation there, you know. But, and some people do say that. Mm. But
the thing is, yeah, it's different. What is different is that the rope snake analogy can be understood in a more complete way by the dream analogy or the imagination.
Yeah.
And once you move from the rope snake to the dream, which is a nice move,
yeah,
and from there to the creation, you can understand, because the duality exists within the dream.
Right.
But in reality, that dream has no substance, no being. So in that way, the fact that there is a snake because we experience it, but in reality it's 100% dependent on the rope. That's why these two terms, mithya and adhishtana, go together. The mithya depends upon an adhishtana for it to have any existence at all. So the adhishtana is what is the substance, the thing that's actually there.
The part where you say that the knower, the self, is not a knower.
Right.
Is knowingness a kind of doership? And that's why you say that?
I don't say knowingness. I say knownness.
Knownness.
It is known. Knowing is a present active participle, right?
Okay.
So that implies that there's a act of knowing. If you just by knowing, but if you say known, that's passive.
Right.
Right. And so a passive voice does not require a knower. So like, for instance, in Sanskrit we'll say there's the passive voice. It doesn't matter what the Sanskrit is. There's a passive voice, and then another type of passive. There's two types of passive voices. One that takes an object, one that takes a subject, and one that doesn't. So one that, in passive construction, one that takes a subject, that subject would be put in the instrumental case, like the boy
knows hit, the dog. Yeah.
The boy hit the ball with a bat.
Yeah.
Right. The bat, that's active. So the ball was hit by the boy. Right. The ball was hit by the boy. I could as well say the ball was hit, but we know that there's an actor in that, right? The ball was hit. But if I say another, it's called bhava prayoga, where it's just the essence of something that does not take an object, like the sun shines. In Sanskrit, what we can say, it was shown by the sun. We can't say it in English. But in Sanskrit, you can use that construction, where the sun is not doing any, the sun is not doing anything. Right? So the shining is reflected back to the sun. Right. And so here, when we say it is known, you know, the Atma is known. Is known is that bhava prayoga. We knock off the object.
Mm-hmm.
The self is known by the self. The self is known. It is known. So there's the known experience of knownness, of conscious being, without a knower.
That was a little tricky for me. I was trying to explain this to somebody, and I got like a hiccup because then I think, and it could be wrong, we say, well, the mind that has the problem, the mind that needs the knowledge.
Yeah.
So then I would assume the mind recognizes the Atma as its being.
It does recognize, but it's a different kind of recognition that's called ajnana nivritti. It's actually just the elimination of ignorance. This is the thing. The self-experience as consciousness is present, completely present, experiential, whether you have knowledge or not. Self-knowledge is not going to give you the experience of the self. Experience, self-experience is ever-present. So when we say the mind gains knowledge of the self, what is actually happening is the mind is differentiating itself from the self-evident consciousness which it had taken to be itself. So there's not the slightest change in the self-experience. It's just that with knowledge, the ignorance that had caused the mind to take the self-experience to belong to it is removed. So there's no new experience of the self. The self-experience is always there. That we say the self is always what we say aparoksha. Aparoksha means that it's not known through sense perception that we call pratyaksha. It's not known through that, through sense perception. It's not known indirectly through paroksha. How is it known then? Aparoksha. Well, it's not indirect because the unnegates the paroksha. It's not indirect because it is self-shining. Right? And so the self-shining, self-evident experience is ever-present. So the self is always aparoksha. But the problem from the standpoint of the mind is that because the mind is mitya, it takes itself totally to be one with the Atma until that viveka jnanam, that knowledge which differentiates, the teaching methodology that differentiates the mind from the self. It makes the mind recognize itself as an object that's coming and going within a stable subject, which it hadn't recognized before.
So from the standpoint of the self, then, is it, talk about this, there's the self evident, obviously, to itself, or the self, whatever. Anyway, what I'm trying to get at is the, is that experience without an experiencer, then?
It is its own experience. There's no subject-object experience.
There's just,
but you don't feel like there's no experience because you are the experience.
You're right.
Yeah.
But from that standpoint, there's a subject-objectless experience going on.
And this never dawns
on
the...
We think that it's just... You don't even think of it like that because it is you. It is the me that is just self-shining. So you don't think that, oh, nobody's knowing me. Mm-hmm. It's just I am known because of my being consciousness, my experience is being known. But I don't think, for one thing, there's no duality to think, but it doesn't have a sense of, oh, I'm being known without a knower, because actually everything is known without a knower.
So it's like ongoing, just like ongoing knowledge, just there.
Yeah. Not knowledge, knownness. Yeah. Knowledge, to me, implies a vritti of some sort, or knowledge of something.
So, referring back to non-dual experience, which my mind then wanted to chase after, in the aftermath of that, I guess I would say you're using a different form of no. I guess my thinking back on it, my experience was there's a knowingness without any particular objects that are known.
If you can say there's a knowingness without a knower known, that's fine.
Yeah,
that's fine. So I say knownness, but you're saying knowingness. As long as you take the verb out of it and the subject-object relationship, it's just self-evident knowing without any type of knower. To me, that doesn't quite work, but it can work as long as it's those words are pointing to that self-evident me.
Then the mind can make comments.
It certainly can, even in meditation. Like sometimes I'll say, you know, ask why we say you're Ananda. The mind can inquire because the self is self-evident. It can be looking at objects or thinking over things, or it can be focused on the self, which is illumining it. And then it can say, well, why am I not it? Or look at how the thoughts come and go. All of these type of things. It's like a meta language over, you know, talking about what is happening or what it's experiencing.
But then when somebody says, I know this, or that's really the Ahankara speaking, right? Because
and in fact, in the Kena Upanishad, one student says something like, I know this, but I can't say that it's known as an object. And then this teacher goes, very good. the way he says it is, he says it really well, you know. It's not he says it like, it's not that I don't know. I do know. But I can't know but it's not known as an object. Somehow in Sanskrit he says it very beautiful. Yeah.
Is there
Edward and
There's two other words, you know, knownness, I see how it's not an activity, but effulgent or illumining, those seem to possess activity.
Well, when you say effulgent, I mean, that's a word sometimes we use for ananda, but illumining, it's sometimes we get away with that word because the sun illumines. Illumining really goes back to something like the sun or a light bulb or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's metaphorical. Mm-hmm. But if we say, you know, just like the sun illumines the world with itself not doing anything, it's the luminary with itself not being involved in any type of activity. Mm-hmm. So consciousness like that is the luminary, even though it's not performing any type of act of illumining, by its very nature, it's a luminary. Like the sun by its nature lights up the whole, whatever comes into its purview, but it itself isn't doing something. It's not doing an act, so I'm going to illumine this. Let me illumine over here.
So would you say that consciousness is a luminary?
Yes. The word luminary is a metaphor for, you know, consciousness is a luminary as consciousness. It's not a luminary like the sun or like a light bulb that we have in, or like fire. These are all luminaries that we can use as examples.
Okay.
But consciousness illumines even the luminary. Right? Consciousness, the sun, we use as an example as a luminary, but consciousness is what illumines the luminary. Right? Or consciousness is what illumines the night. Because of consciousness, the night is known. Because of consciousness, the sun is known. Right? Without consciousness, there's... Consciousness is the ultimate luminary.
Yeah.
If we want to talk like that. But we have to be careful of our metaphors to make sure we don't think that consciousness has become...
But there is a vocabulary going around consciousness.
Yes, there is. But we use this all the time, right?
Yeah.
Luminary.
Is there a problem with luminary like the sun because the sun illuminates other objects in non-dual experience? There aren't the other objects that are being illumined.
Well, we would say yes, from the standpoint of awareness, it is non-dual. So, in fact, it is the luminary for everything that exists within the creation. So if you look at consciousness as the luminary or the self-evident consciousness because of which the whole dream world is illumined, including the dream sun, right? The dream sun and the dream characters, the dream minds, the dream activity, the very being of the whole dream and the knownness of the dream are all because of that one non-dual consciousness. We say non-dual because the dream is like the snake in the rope snake. It has no independent being apart from consciousness. But the dream enjoys consciousness completely for its existence and for its knownness. So consciousness is the ultimate luminary that is the luminary even because of which the sun and the stars and the night, everything is known.
Originally, the Upanishads were recited, is that right?
Well, like there were before writing came along too late in the game.
I'm just
it's always an oral tradition.
Right.
That's why there's so much you know, with the swaras and everything, like when we're learning the Ganapata for the Gayatri, those are all learning techniques for incredible memorization.
I was wondering if there is there a meta meaning to the, like to the rhythm of it, or to, you know, like is there a music to it? Have you heard it recited? Has Swamiji ever talked about it? The actual reciting, does that add to the meaning of it? Is what I'm asking.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we learn the meaning, and sometimes the Vedic grammar is a little bit different than the classical grammar, but then we always learn what those differences are in the Bhasha. So we are learning the meaning. It's true that in ancient, in Vedic Sanskrit, and when things are, we are learning something with the swaras, you know, the notes, it does matter. Like, there's a difference. Like if I said, Indra, or Indra, two different meanings. So that's why you have to be very particular when you're learning something with the swaras that you're chanting it right. That's why they make such an emphasis that the swaras can actually change the meaning. So I don't know about all of that, except that I learn, I try to learn it and always do it properly.
Yeah.
And always say before you chant, you say Om Tat Sat, and after you finish, you say Om Tat Sat.
That's like a free pass.
It's like catch 22.
Yeah, because it's asking for a blessing that you said correctly. Even at the end of the when we do the chanting of the temple for an hour and a half of chanting, at the end there's a prayer. It says, Bhagavan, please receive this. It's been done with all shraddha and all proper pronunciation.
Well, I know that, see, I was thinking in terms of, like there was just a book written recently by that man who's a neurologist, Oliver Sacks, about how music affects the mind.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
And maybe
does.
There's something also about the sound of it that helps contribute to the meaning, is what I mean.
I don't know how it contributes to the meaning, but I know that the sound and the swaras and the chanting is very something powerful.
So, the Ananda is ever present.
Ananda.
Ananda.
Yeah.
And what did I say?
Ananda.
Oh, okay. Came out wrong. Okay, the Ananda is always present, even in the worst dukkha-vritti.
Yep. Even in the very worst.
And sometimes, if there is ignorance present, then the mind isn't really distinguishing that Ananda, and it might even, in a sense, from the mind's perspective, get kind of ground out or so far in the background that it's almost not as if it wasn't there.
Yeah, sometimes we use the example of like a sun illuminating a bucket of water that's full of mud. the nature of the mind is so dense with its pain, you know, that it doesn't really have the capacity, it's from its own standpoint, it's not really reflecting the sun much, so there's a big feeling, would be a big feeling of darkness and isolation and all those awful feelings, you know. But for Jnani, the one who has that viveka, that's the self that you are is ever present. It's ever present anyway, but that mind is so lost in its own pain that, and it has no capacity and has never had a capacity to differentiate itself, the self, from its mental state. It just takes the self is totally overwhelmed or consumed by the mental state, even though it really isn't. Once it's pointed out, then that viveka, that discrimination is there, but until it's pointed out, the mind is only focused on its own mental states. And then that's why when the mind becomes like a clear water, you know, you feel so happy because this is how you're supposed to be and all that, you know, because the mind is not contributing its own darkness or stress, level of stress.
So for Jnani, even in the severe dukkha-vrittis, Ananda is present. And the darkness is also present.
Yeah.
It's just that there's kind of a foreground, background.
Yeah, that's right. But remember that the word Ananda is dangerous because it's You have to know what they mean by ananda for yourself, and that can only be gotten by like asking that question, so that you recognize that ananda is particular to you and never not there, that which is the most beloved. And so for jnani, especially if your mind is getting a little out of control, or if something has happened that put your mind in some kind of pain, still yourself is very, very present because the viveka is there. And so then you just have to have that skill, I would say it's even like a practice, to realize that your mind's creating a nightmare for you.
Stormy wet.
Yeah, stormy. It's a big storm. It's a big storm.
When it creates...
It's creating a big storm, and so you know how to pull your mind back, to just come back to yourself. You have to fall in love with that practice. Just fall in love with it, so that it's so easy. It becomes very easy. You just bring your mind back and everything's fine. You just come back to the present.
Can you say more about that falling in love? Because it seems like the self doesn't have the same agenda.
I wasn't talking about the self falling in love. I was talking about your mind.
Oh, okay.
Falling in love with the habit of doing it.
So what?
So no matter how bad it gets, you just can do it right now without having to practice or gin it up. It's just like that.
Exactly. Exactly right. Exactly right. And you love to do that because it takes some time because the mind feels always, it has to get over its self-righteousness and it's in, you know, the...
That's
a
big one.
Yeah, like
never.
They did wrong to me and they deserve my misery. You know, whatever stupid stuff it is. You know, it's so stupid. It's like you're giving way too much real estate and the other people are just fine, they're just going their way and you're just, you know, suffering. So you learn just how to do it and you love to have that skill.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, say if you're a tennis player, you play the piano or you play a musical instrument or you have a beautiful voice, you can just do that, you know, because you've developed that capacity. And now you develop it in territory that an ajnani, when it doesn't have self-knowledge, doesn't have that territory, because that viveka is not there.
And that skill, that's an ongoing skill. It's not like you put it in operation once, and then the muddy bucket.
Yeah, no. Just as David said, it's a skill that you naturally do. When your mind is acting out like that, you just bring it home.
So if there's a heavy-duty darkness, you have that skill, you can bring your mind back to yourself. You see that for a moment. But then you have to do that again right away.
You may have to do it again right away, and you may have to, as you do that, you might have to have a little talk with your mind. Like you may have to do some, seriously, you may have to do some inner child work, talking to the little ones inside and find out what's really hurting you. You know, if your mind keeps, you bring it back and then bring it back, then you might have to do some inner child work, or you may have to bring in your knowledge, do inner child work because there's some complexes and hurts inside, or bring in your knowledge, you know, like to whatever degree. I mean, the fact is, if you're going to be attached to this thing being in a particular way and having this in a particular way, you're going to have stress.
Yeah.
The two go together.
Yeah.
You know? So you have to give it back to Bhagavan. In the end, just let Ishwara do it, whatever.
You're
because your ananda, your wholeness, is not, your very being is Bhagawan's being. It's even Bhagawan, Swamiji used to joke, even Bhagawan can't take away yourself. Nobody can do anything to it. So if you get stuck, if you get stuck out here, well, I need this to be like this or that to be like that, then I'm going to, for the very instant that happens, there's stress. Because you're not safe. Somebody can take it away. And if it's a little thing, we call that, if it's just a little desire where it doesn't really matter, then we call that a dagda bija. It's a burnt seed. Like, yeah, I want that, but if it doesn't happen, that's fine too. That's not a problem.
But when
it could even be a big thing. Yeah.
Sorry. Could I add one more thing about that rope snake? Just one thing. And because there is another way that I've heard you use it, which is from the point of view of the individual, which is that, you know, the two people walking and one mistakes the rope for the snake.
Yes, that's another way to use it.
Other points it out. Mm-hmm. So in that usage, what is the snake and what is the rope? Is that yourself? Is the snake the Dehatma Bodhi and the rope is the Atma?
That example is kind of also just like the, in a sense, the tenth man story, is that you're reacting to something that is not there. You know? Tenth man story is probably the greatest story for that, but the rope snake is good also. Because you don't see what is there, and you don't see what is there, so you're reacting to what isn't there, but you've experienced it. Mithya is not what we call tucham. Tucham means absolutely non-existent. So you're walking around, you're walking along, the two boys are walking along and they don't see anything, there's no problem, you know? But here, you're walking along and this boy mistakes a rope for a snake. He never sees the rope, he only sees the snake, and that is his emotional reality. And so our emotional reality is based upon ajnanam.
I see
that. Yeah. So that's a good example. Tenth man's story is a great example for that too, because the whole teaching tradition comes in with that example. Are we done?
Thank you.
We're done.
Until next time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.